For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host, Red Sale.
I'm Robert Kirkwood. And coming up today,
Claire Marchant introduces us to her new time slip novel,
The Secrets of Saffron Hall.
I ask some talking book narrators for their favourite books.
We travel back in time with Nicola Cornick and her novel The Woman in the Lake.
And then a return to Claire Marchant for the books of her life. That's all coming up in today's show. But first on today's show, Gabby Wood, the literary director of the Booker Prize Foundation, was joined by this year's five judges. Chair Margaret Busby, Lee Child, Samir Rahim, Lem Sissé and Emily Wilson to reveal this year's Booker Prize shortlist.
Hello everyone and welcome to our live and somewhat futuristic press conference. I can't see you, but allow me to introduce you to Margaret Busby, chair of the panel. Margaret is a writer, editor, former publisher and behind-the-scenes influencer extraordinaire, before that word was ever used. And Lee Child, this is in alphabetical order, by the way, who is the father of the mega best-selling Jack Reacher phenomenon, as you of course know, and now a full-time reader, apparently, although this process may have put you off, Lee, I'm not sure. Next, we have Samir Rahim, arts and books editor, also managing editor of Prospect magazine, and one of the most intellectually agile journalists I know. Lem Sissé is the next judge on the list, a poet, a broadcaster, and now a memoirist, author of the extraordinary and best-selling memoir, My Name is Why. And lastly, Emily Wilson, who is the first woman to have translated the Odyssey into English, though her gender is neither here nor there, since it just happens to be a very beautiful translation. Now, over to Margaret, who will introduce this year's picture.
The year 2020 will stand out in memory, especially because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Lockdown has meant that as judges, we've never all been together physically in a room. Instead, holding virtual meetings, patching in various time zones as we hunkered down in different parts of the world. Thanks to Gabby Wood, Dottie Irving, Hannah Davis, Miriam Dennis, and all the four communications team for ensuring that things have run so smoothly. And the additional backdrop, as Gabby has said, has been the international foregrounding of the Black Lives Matter movement in the wake of tragedies that should never, never happen. And they have been deep personal heartbreak to process. In my case, the loss of my sister. Yet in July, we managed to come up with our long list, the Booker Dozen. Sadly, saying goodbye to other titles we enjoyed along the way. And now to reach this next stage is reminiscent of a gathering under lockdown rules when only six are allowed, although there are scores to whom one might wish to give a warm hug. But what pleasure we do take in the company of those who remain. So who are our chosen few for this stage of the party? Well, in alphabetical order, they are Diane Cook, The New Wilderness, Tsitsi Dangarembga, This Mournable Body, Avni Doshi, Burnt Sugar, Maza Mengisti, The Shadow King, Douglas Stewart, Shuggy Bain, and Brandon Taylor, Real Life.
And we'll have more on those books and hopefully be talking to the authors in future editions of Read On. There then followed a short package about why the judges chose the books they had.
Every book that we've chosen makes one bring all one's attention, emotions, to understanding what the writer was trying to say. And I think that is important.
It's exciting to realise that there are so many interesting female authors out there. There are so many interesting non-white authors out there giving us different glimpses of what the world is all about, telling interesting and vibrant stories.
We were looking for books that really told a story and grabbed us. We were looking for originality as well. And personally, I was also looking for technical mastery, And at the level of the sentence, it needed to be really, really superb.
Every one of these books is an experience which has inspired us and therefore will inspire the reader.
You have got to read them. If you read the shortlist, it will show you where the novel is right now in 2020, and it will give you a pretty good idea of where it might go in the future.
Aaron Ibe has worked with the Booker Prize Foundation for over a decade to ensure that some of the year's best novels are made available to blind and partially sighted people. Book titles are not always automatically produced in alternative reading formats, such as audio, and particularly in large print or braille, which means people with sight loss often have to wait much longer to get hold of the latest and most popular books. RNIB work with the Booker Prize Foundation to make sure the shortlisted titles in the Booker Prize are produced in all formats, as close to the shortlist announcement as possible. The Booker Prize Foundation funds the production of the shortlisted titles in braille, giant print and in audio. Now back to the press conference, and once again, here's Gabby Wood, Literary Director of the Booker Prize Foundation.
Robert Kirkwood, RNIB Connect Radio. Thank you, Robert. You're getting to work working the audiobooks, but a special RNIB audiobooks of these books. This is something that the Booker Prize Foundation contributes to. Do the judges think that listening to them as audio changes the reading experience? Be worth knowing that for the blind and partially sighted audience.
We didn't have audio for most of the books. I got the Hilary Mantel on audio and I really enjoyed it as an audiobook. I thought that the reader did a fantastic job of differentiating the different characters with his voice. So I personally think that an audiobook is very often a much more vibrant experience if the reader does a good job with it. It can, and also you can then be reading while you're walking, which is a totally different experience from reading while you're sitting. So I think it is a different experience. I think you can also pay attention in a somewhat different way. I find I pay attention to particular things differently when it's on the page versus auditory. I don't think it necessarily would change the judgment, but I think it's experientially different.
Thanks to Emily Wilson and all the judges. More from the Booker Prize coming up in future shows, but for now, it's over to Red.
The Secrets of Saffron Hall is the new historical romance from Claire Marchant. A dual time novel set both in the present day and during the reign of Henry VIII, it tells the story of two women whose lives are separated by 500 years but inextricably linked by a rare spice. Here's Claire to tell us more. Claire, welcome to Read On.
Hello, thank you very much. Great to be here.
So the book is a dual time novel, and half of the story is set during 1538 with the marriage of a very young woman to a very ambitious merchant.
That's right. So Eleanor is 17 when the book starts. And as happened in those days, young ladies didn't have much choice, if any choice, about who they married. And her cousin has arrived having inherited her family home after the death of her father. And yes, he marries her off to, as you say, an ambitious merchant who lives in North Norfolk. So her life is turned around just like that.
And her only dowry comes from the priory, where she has found more help and support than from her cousin.
That's right. She spent a lot of time at the priory with her father. It's close to the house where she was living. So she's grown up with the monks. And as you say, the prior gives her a small chest as a dowry containing what turns out to be saffron corms, the small bulbs that grow the crocuses that we get saffron from. So that is all she takes with her.
And she cultivates these in her new married home and really makes her new husband's fortune.
Absolutely. More valuable than gold. So she starts growing it. She's already worked with the monks, so she knows how to cultivate it. And yes, she starts producing the saffron. And very quickly, her husband, Greville, realizes that he can make a lot of money out of it, more so than he was as a merchant. And as we all know, in Tudor times, money was everything. You could not progress or progress at court unless you were rich.
And as we also know, Henry VIII's court is a perilous place to be, because you can rise very quickly, but you can fall just as rapidly.
Yes, indeed. That's one of the reasons that I love Tudor history, because it was so volatile. Everybody wanted to be friends with the king. Everybody wanted to rise. That was the way that you got on in life. And yet, a flick of his fingers, you were gone. And quite often, your head was no longer attached to your shoulders. I love that, the volatile nature of the courts then.
The other half of the story, told in 2019, is about Amber, who has gone to her ancestral family home, Saffron Hall, in Norfolk, to recover from an emotional trauma, and she makes a discovery.
That's right. While she's at the hall, there's a thunderstorm, and the tower on one corner of the hall is damaged. So they have to get builders in to have a look. Turns out the damage is far worse than originally thought. And as they start to take the tower apart, they find on the windowsill of an upstairs tower room a small book of hours with secrets within.
And it starts to unravel a fascinating mystery that reveals why Saffron is so important in the family history, and a rather tragic occurrence that we will not go into because it would be a spoiler.
Well, that's right. Yes, we don't want to spoil it for anybody. But yes, it does unravel a mystery. And that was great, sort of being able to write that. So she slowly starts to learn in a book of hours. There were prayer books in medieval times for women to carry about, but quite often they had spare pages that were deliberately left blank so that the ladies could write in whatever they wished, really. Sometimes it might have just been recipes or special occasions. But as you say, Eleanor has written in this book of hours, and slowly Amber is able to discover what happens in Eleanor's life and the culmination of her life and her story.
She also finds a lot of emotional parallels in those pages as well, doesn't she?
Yes, that's right. There are a lot of them. Both women are going through at the time, and that is a comfort to her. There's a Latin proverb that she finds in there, the family motto, Dum Spiro Spero, which translates as "While I breathe, I hope." And that was a theme that I tried to carry right through the book, because we do all go through times in our life where things are very sad and black. But I do believe that we keep breathing and we keep hoping and things turn out all right again.
Well, I was very much struck by that whilst I was listening to the audiobook. It's very much a book for our times, where we might be tempted to think about the freedoms that we've lost, but actually one should enjoy the life that we have.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm a great optimist. I've always been a glass half full sort of person. So yes, we do have to enjoy what we have and look forward to happier times again. And as you say, at the moment, things have been very glum and we've all had to go through some hardships. And it can be difficult for any of us to get up every day and feel cheerful. I don't think I do. I definitely don't do that every day. But I do certainly always have hope that things will get better again. I do certainly still believe that. So yes, the whole theme, While I Breathe, I Hope, I felt was very important. And obviously, while I was writing the book, I had no idea what was going to happen in 2020.
Saffron Hall is a very vividly drawn house. I was wondering whether you were inspired by a particular building that you'd seen.
I was indeed, although it's a bit of a mix of more than one. Living up here in Norfolk, we're lucky that we have a lot of ruins and a lot of National Trust houses. So the main house that gave me the inspiration was a place called Oxborough Hall here in Norfolk. And it has a small chapel just close by and a tower on one corner. It does have a moat, which Saffron Hall doesn't have, but it has the courtyard and the gatehouse. So that was my main inspiration. Although having said that, I also like Castle Rising in Norfolk, which is now derelict, but was in the right position. So I sort of chose a house. I moved it to where I wanted to be in Norfolk. So all sorts of different places around about me that I used as inspiration. But the main house is Oxborough Hall.
And you're quite meticulous in your research. Do you find it difficult to move from the research to the writing, or is there always a moment where you think, I've got enough, it's time to put fingers to keyboard?
It is so difficult. It really is. I love the research. My background is in history. And it's very difficult to think, Claire, you better get on and write this book now, because I start reading one thing and it leads to another and it's a rabbit hole and I can't stop doing the research. So, yes, I do try and have a cutoff point where I think I have enough now to at least start. There's always small points that I have to go back and check because I am meticulous. Anything that really happened, I have to have it spot on. So there's always bits to go back and look at.
And the book has been brought vividly to life by Hattie Ladbury, who's a terrific narrator and not one who I'd come across before. Did you have anything to do with her being selected?
Well, not really. I gave the okay. I was told this is who they were thinking of narrating it, and it wasn't somebody that I particularly knew. So I was able to listen to some short pieces that she'd done, and yes, I just thought she'd be perfect for it. So I was more than happy that they went with Hattie.
Would you like me to help carry anything? Grandad leant in the study doorway, a mug of tea in one hand and a stack of custard creams in the other. Amber looked up from the dusty box she was emptying, piling the contents onto the front of the desk where she was fast running out of space. Her pallid face was thin and pinched. Deep shadows smudged like bruises under her eyes reflected the hours she lay awake at night, whilst all around her slept. "Grandad, you can't lift them. Don't even think about it," she admonished. Biscuits were probably the heaviest thing he could carry these days. "You look too pale," he observed. "You should eat more." Amber ducked her head back into the box she was emptying and rolled her eyes. "I'm always this colour. It goes with the red hair." Her parents had used little imagination when they'd named her Amber. Standing up, she placed a handful of old London A to Z's on top of a precarious pile of almost identical copies dating from the 1950s. "Really?" She indicated them and raised her eyebrows. "Were you thinking of doing the knowledge?" She gave him a wry smile. It was Grandad's turn to roll his eyes. "Don't change the subject," he told her, frowning from beneath his overgrown eyebrows, now almost white, but still holding faint traces of his own auburn colouring. "So I've set up a spreadsheet to catalogue everything," she carried on as if he hadn't spoken, "and I'm noting the location of the books in the house so you can find them later when you decide what to do with them." "That all sounds very efficient." "It's what we agreed," she reminded him. "My skills as an archivist in exchange for bed and board. And a place to hide." She left the words unsaid.
Hattie Ladbury narrating The Secrets of Saffron Hall, written by my guest, Claire Marchant. Claire, are you a fan of audiobooks yourself?
I must confess, I'm not. I find it very difficult just to listen to things. I find that my mind wanders. I'm terrible for that. I can't even watch the television, really. I'm much better with an actual physical book to read. So I'm not very much of an audiobook person. But it is something I would like to get into more, certainly on long car journeys and things like that. It would be wonderful.
Now, I've heard a lot of people say how striking the cover of The Secrets of Saffron Hall is. For a blind and partially sighted audience, can you describe the image on the front of the book?
It shows an archway with some greenery around it, beautiful ornate archway, and there are some small purple flowers around the bottom of the arch. It's definitely Renaissance style, very old-fashioned. And in the centre, we have a young lady walking away. We can only see her back. She's in Tudor costume, beautiful Tudor gown. And she's walking towards what is very obviously Saffron Hall. And it's got the tower on one corner and all the tiny Tudor windows. So it has an air of mystery about it. The skies are cloudy, what I would call lowering cloud grey. A wonderful sense of mystery. Where is she walking? There's all the grounds of the house. So, yeah, I love the cover. Absolutely love it.
You say that you also love the Tudor period of history. Are you already writing another book that's set during the same period, or do you think you might ever branch out into another era?
I am writing a second book in Tudor era, another dual timeline, so Tudor and present day. This is a slightly different Tudor era in that it's at the court of Queen Elizabeth. So I sort of moved on a few years, because although it's not a sequel to Saffron Hall, there are some characters who are the same. I don't know whether I would ever branch out from Tudor, because I love it. I do like medieval era, so possibly a little earlier than Tudor. But at the moment, I cannot think of another era that I love as much. And it's just so rich in history and what we know about it that, yes, can't imagine at the moment that I would move on from Tudor. Certainly not yet. Still got lots more stories inside me.
Fantastic. Well, it is a very rich period of British history. And I think the win big, lose big nature of the Tudor court is something that actually chimes very well with our own 21st century culture.
Yes, that is very true. I hadn't really thought of it like that, but that's a very prophetic thing to say, that yes, we can fly high, but the higher you fly, the further you fall. And certainly I think with celebrities, we see this all the time on the news. One minute they're everybody's darling, and the next minute they've put one foot wrong, or there's a social media post that's wrong. And they might not lose their heads these days, but they can certainly lose their fortunes and their favour just as quickly.
Well, Claire Marchant, thank you so much for coming onto the show and leading us into the world of the secrets of Saffron Hall. And I hope you'll come back at the end of the show to share the books of your life.
I will, and thank you very much for having me. It's been great fun.
The Secrets of Saffron Hall is available from the RNIB Talking Books Library. And as promised, Claire will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. Now, here's Robert with some of our favourite narrators.
Talking Books narrators are perhaps the keenest and most careful of readers. When they read a book out loud in studio, it's perhaps the third or the fourth time that they have experienced that text from cover to cover, working on pronunciations, tricky sentences and accents for all of the minor characters. So, at a very noisy gathering of narrators, I felt fairly confident I'd be recommended some amazing talking books when I asked them about the best one they have ever narrated.
One of the good things is that RNIB has a kind of collective memory.
Christopher Oxford.
And if you've done one in a series of books, as for example the Patrick O'Brien books, they remember that and they call you back to do them on another occasion. So I've recorded now probably four or five of the Patrick O'Brien series, and of course I'm looking forward to completing the series eventually. And you keep in your mind, in your memory bank, a store of characters that you can reanimate for each new book that you do, and that's lovely because it gives a sense of continuity. So that's one that I would remember in particular.
HMS Surprise by Patrick O'Brien. But I put it to you, my lord, that prize money is of essential importance to the Navy. The possibility, however remote, of making a fortune by some brilliant stroke is an unparalleled spur to the diligence, the activity, and the unremitting attention of every man afloat. I am sure that the serving members of the board will support me in this, he said, glancing round the table. Several of the uniformed figures looked up, and there was a murmur of agreement.
Going back to our old days at Listening Books, where you and I worked together, we recorded the Philip Pullman, His Dark Materials trilogy, which I remember with particular pleasure because there were so many different characters, and it was so well written by a teacher who'd often had to tell these stories to kids, that I found that a very positive and rewarding experience as a performer, interpreting all the different characters.
Christopher Oxford was reading HMS Surprise by Patrick O'Brien. It's 14 hours, 7 minutes long, and the catalogue number is 14315. Next up, Stephanie Beattie.
One of them for me has to be my favourite of all time is Gillespie and I. I just love it. It's set in Glasgow at the time of the Great Exhibition of 1888. It's a thriller It's got tremendous twists in it. It's hilariously funny. There's a particular scene set in Hampstead Pond with somebody swimming. I will say no more than that because I don't want to give anything away, but it is a scream. And it's a huge tome. It's not one that you can easily read in bed, but you can easily listen to it and lose yourself in it. That's got to be it.
Fresh air was what I craved. Fresh air and distraction. To escape the odour of hothouse funeral flowers and to purge my mind of bad memories. As you may remember, the first Glasgow International Exhibition was staged in the year 88. For several months, the newspapers had talked of little else, and it occurred to me that some solace might be found in a sojourn to the magnificent spectacle that was said to bestraddle both banks of the River Kelvin. Thus, in the second week of May, having closed up my aunt's little house in Clerkenwell, I took the train to Scotland.
Gillespie and I by Jane Harris, read by Stephanie Beattie, lasts 17 hours and 50 minutes. It's talking book number 18842. Now, visually impaired narrator Giles Abbott tells me about his favourite, a well-self book called The Butt, An Exit Strategy.
There were places in which the writing was breathtaking. There were also incredibly long, multi-clausal sentences and some very long made-up names. And he's living in a world whereby smoking is now a capital offence, smoking in public or something like that, I forget. His life is turned upside down. He ends up in this very strange... There's a strange traditional society where he's staying, which is kind of Australia and kind of Iraq and kind of all sorts of places. And it's all about how do you accommodate for different cultural practices and how much do you and how much should you. And it's wonderfully weird. And his life is turned horribly upside down. More characters than you could shake a stick at. So, you know, I'd prepared, I'd read, but every time I came to a new character, I just thought, okay, here goes. And just sort of did something different with my vocal anatomy. I'm also a trained voice teacher, so I can pull various stunts with the old poets, you know what I mean? And so it was a fun challenge. It was the first one, so I guess that sticks in the mind.
The whole garish infrastructure of this public health campaign appeared, even to Tom's indolent ethical eye, to have been imposed on the country's polyglot and heavy puffing population, in place of any more commanding civic morality. And so it all had grated on Tom, turning those little interludes of cloudy self-absorption into hurried and unsatisfying liaison with La Divina Nicotina. Yes, giving up would free him from such bondages, while, at the same time, he would find liberation in doing the right thing, facing up to his mortality, his responsibilities as a father, a husband, and a citizen. No longer would he sustain his individualism with such puerile puffing.
Giles Abbott was reading The Butt, An Exit Strategy by Will Self. It lasts 12 hours, 6 minutes, and it's catalogue number 16236, and it contains language that might be considered offensive. Now, Christopher Ragland tells me about a few books that have stuck in his mind.
I've done a few biographies, which were quite cool. There was a biography of Dave Grohl, who's the lead singer for Foo Fighters, and that was a really interesting, especially for anybody who likes music, because he has such a love for music, which is fantastic. There was a long one called Matterhorn, which is about the Vietnam War, a kind of semi-autobiographical account, but a fictional story, and that's fantastic. And 127 Hours, if anybody wants to read about a guy having their arm almost... Oh no! Actually, eventually torn off after a while. So all of those were quite fun to quite get into.
I know in 127 hours it's hard to read, it's hard to watch in the film. How was it to narrate?
Hard as well. I mean, especially when you got to the point where he's doing the things that he's having to do to himself, and it's a bit. I would say the hardest part about that book actually is he really describes. He makes a video at one point to his parents and having to try and get yourself in the position where you're making that video for your parents saying, I'm going to be dead when you find this. That was quite intense. And then when he described cutting through his arm, which as you do on a normal day. But it was all quite cool.
On Sunday, April 27th, 2003, 27-year-old Aaron Ralston set off for a day's hiking in the Utah Canyons. Dressed in a t-shirt and shorts, Ralston, a seasoned climber, figured he'd hike for a few hours and then head off to work. 40 miles from the nearest paved road, he found himself on top of an 800-pound boulder. As he slid down and off of the boulder, it shifted, trapping his right hand against the canyon wall. No one knew where he was. He had little water, he wasn't dressed correctly, and the boulder wasn't going anywhere. He remained trapped for 5 days in the canyon. This is the account of those 5 days, of the years that led up to them, and where he goes from here. This book contains language and passages of a disturbing nature that might be considered offensive.
It really, really does. 127 hours between a rock and a hard place by Aaron Ralston is 12 hours 35 minutes long, and it's talking book number 18599. Now, sometimes narrators are introduced to new genres that they normally wouldn't read. Here's Eric Myers.
Philip K. Dick, series of short stories. I had a joy doing those. And I never realized that I was somebody who might be interested in elements of science fiction. And his writing I found very refreshing and, you know, unique. So I was more interested in clever and psychological pieces of science fiction after that. So reading that, and I'm glad it was suggested to me.
And sometimes narrators have simply done too many books to recommend a favourite. Here's Hayward Morse.
There are several I do, although we may not realize it by the way I speak naturally, but I spent a lot of time living in North America, so I've done mainly American books for the RNIB, and some of them have been terribly interesting. Usually it's very interesting when you get to know books and books that sell and books that don't sell, and quite often they're the books that aren't terribly popular or very well known but are really imaginatively written and perhaps a bit surreal and quite unusual, and yet they're not bestsellers or popular in that way. I think, if anything, that's what I've usually found about the books that have interested me. They're not the big bestsellers in the commercial sense, you know. They're like discoveries, which is always nice for me.
My favourite book, you asked what my favourite book is.
John Chancer.
That's very difficult to say. I think the last count is I must have recorded about 430 books in the last 30-odd years, and I would say that it would be impossible for me to say which one would be the most favourite one. I can't tell you that, but thank you, and I hope your listeners will carry on enjoy reading all our lovely books at the RNIB.
Thanks to all of the narrators of RNIB Talking Books. For more information on the Talking Book service and to request specific books, you can head to www.rnib.org.uk/library.
RNIB Library has all the latest reading titles in a format that suits your needs. You choose the books, you choose the format, we deliver to your door. Follow us on Twitter at RNIB Library or find us on Facebook.
You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. We've already had Claire Marchant on the show talking about her time slip novel, but another time slipper is Nicola Cornick. Here she is on her first visit to Read On.
Nicola Cornick is a best-selling author of historical romances. Her time slip mysteries blend past and present with elements of science fantasy and classic suspense fiction. Her new novel, The Woman in the Lake, is out now, and as I discovered, it reflects Nicola's keen interest in public history.
It's a dual time novel, so it's set in
the current day and in the 18th century. There's a historical mystery in the 18th century which is solved in the present. And it's also set in the town of Swindon, which is maybe quite a surprising setting for a romantic historical mystery, but it was a fascinating bit of research to do for that.
Yes, I learned a huge amount about Swindon. I didn't realise it had such a rich history in the smuggling trade of the 18th century.
Yes, well, I've lived near Swindon for over 20 years now, and for a long time I thought it didn't have any history that predated the railways, really. It's kind of famous for that, but nothing else. So, I mean, you can imagine how surprised and excited I was to discover all this other stuff that had gone on beforehand, especially something as exciting as smuggling, which I mean, you wouldn't really expect in a town that's a considerable distance from the sea. But that was one of the really interesting things about it, the sort of the land smuggling side of things. So, yeah, an awful lot of stuff to find out there.
Yes, it was a kind of distribution point for brandy smuggling, and it gave rise to the word moonraker. Can you expand on that a bit, please?
Yes, well, that's our local legend around here, of course, which is that when the excise men came along and surprised some of the local smugglers just as they were hiding some kegs of brandy in one of the local ponds, one of the sites of which it was actually said to be in Swindon itself, was where this happened. And so the locals, being very quick-witted, put on their sort of yokel act and pretended that they were just trying to catch the full moon. The reflection of it was floating in the waters. So when the excise men said, "What are you doing?" they said, "Well, we're trying to catch the moon with their rakes," hence the name moonraker. So of course the customs people just thought, "Well, they're all a bit stupid," and rode off and left them there. And of course they were left there with all their brandy.
In all your books, whether they've been the Mills and Boone books or the time slip novels that you've been writing more recently, you have always shown a real love and desire for historical accuracy. It's core to the way you write.
Well, thank you. Yes, I try really hard to write within an authentic historical framework, because I think even if you're writing fiction and so you're speculating on what people might have said or what they might have thought, you can still make that as true to the period that you're writing about as possible. So yes, that's really important to me, both because I studied history, but I mean also I just think it adds so much to the story as well. It really creates the setting and the background like an extra character almost, I think, if you've got a rich and vivid history.
You studied a postgrad degree in public history, didn't you?
Yes.
So it's very much the sort of social history, the history of the people and the towns.
That's right, yes, the history of the people who you might not normally hear from, the ones who weren't writing it at the time but still obviously had a really important history themselves. So the ordinary people, though, obviously the more you study, the more you realise nobody was that ordinary, or women or minorities who didn't really have a voice. So bringing that out is part of what I studied, and also making it more accessible for a wider group of people, because in my work, when I show people around the National Trust place where I work, for example, you're telling stories and trying to make that history appealing and accessible to the people who've come to visit. So that's all part of the public history idea.
And you clearly see houses as the living embodiment of the history. I know Ashdown House, where you are a volunteer, featured in your first time slip novel, House of Shadows.
Yes, it was the inspiration for House of Shadows. That was a book I'd wanted to write for about 12 years. So that was very exciting, being able to do that. And yes, I mean, I think that's really interesting, because of course most houses change over time, both physically and sort of in terms of their contents and the people who've lived there and the stories that you can tell about them. So yes, there's a repository of all these stories, of all this history. It's a fascinating thing to explore.
And I suppose they're the microcosm of where the different classes meet and interact socially.
Yes, absolutely, and not always necessarily in the way that you might think, not always in such a hierarchical way, or at least it was, but often you find the lines blurred. I mean, Ashdown was a great example of that, because it was a sporting estate. There was far more mingling between the servant and the people actually living in the house, because when they were doing their outdoor pursuits, they were kind of all in it together. So there was a cricket team, for example, that not only had all the members of the Craven family, but also anybody locally who was any good with a batter and a ball was drafted in to join their team. So it blurred those boundaries a bit, and there's some really interesting stories there, I think.
And Lydiard House, that is at the centre of the new book, is that a creation of your imagination?
No, Lydiard House is a real place that you can visit. So, yes, again, when I first came to Swindon, I had no idea that there was this beautiful Palladian mansion that actually is run by the council and by a trust now, which is open to the public. And the downstairs of that has been restored to as it would have been in the 18th century. And that was one of the amazing things about having that there when I was writing the book, because I could actually walk through those rooms that I talk about in the story, and they are exactly as they are in the book, the dressing room with the window with all the gorgeous stained glass in it and that kind of thing. And that's really inspiring, of course, as a writer, to stand in the place that you're actually writing about and imagine yourself going back in time. So, yeah, it's a fabulous place that is Lydiard Park.
And how do you know when to stop doing the historical research and actually put pen to paper?
Well, that is very hard. To be honest, I spend far too much time on my research, which is easy to justify, of course, because you can say, well, it's really important that I get this right. And then, of course, you find something else interesting and you're off on another tangent. I think that is very hard if you're a historical author who loves the history, because, yes, you can then procrastinate about actually writing and spend so much time on research that you just never get going with it. You've got to be really disciplined with yourself, I think, and just say, right, today I'm going to sit down and I'm actually going to write. And then that can be a treat, actually, if you want to do that afterwards, but not before you've done your 1,000 words or whatever.
Now, there's history and romance in your books. I was actually rather impressed that you don't romanticise the dark side of history. The moonrakers, the smugglers, are portrayed as what they are, rather yes, brutal criminals.
Absolutely, yes, they're not heroes. This is a very interesting difference maybe between historical romance and historical fiction. When I was writing historical romance, one of the last books that I wrote, a Regency romance, had whisky smuggling in it. And of course, the whisky smugglers in that were far more heroic, maybe because they were prompted to do it for altruistic reasons. But the truth of the matter is that as a historian, as we all know, highwaymen and footpads and smugglers and all these people who have been kind of romanticised as heroes, maybe because it feels as though they were sort of Robin Hood characters on the side of the poor, they were actually basically just criminals, and that's all there is to say about that. And I think it is important sometimes that that's clear, that it wasn't a romantic pastime at all. It was dangerous. It was pretty unpleasant, really.
And there's another dark side to the book. The dual timelines are linked by a cursed object, a golden gown, which is, well, again, drawn from history.
Yes, well, that was very interesting, actually, because the whole idea of the gown was what started this book off. Lots of inspirations came together for it, but I wanted to write about a dress. I knew that before I wrote the rest of the story, and I hadn't really had the idea of having a, it's difficult, I don't want to give too many spoilers here, but I hadn't had the idea of it actually being a physically dangerous object until I went to a talk at a literary festival about poisons and their various uses. I'll say no more than that. And that was what actually gave me this idea of this dress and how it was physically dangerous, but there was also a kind of psychological element to that, the malevolent influence it could have on people. I mean, this is quite a dark book. I'm getting that feedback from readers. I hope it's not too dark, but I think it's interesting to explore those kinds of themes.
I thought the dress was also rather emblematic of the domestic violence that travels yeah, through history as well.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes, I don't want to give too much away. And I'd also like to stress it's a very entertaining read, as well as, I think, accurately reflecting some of the darker sides of human nature that we really shouldn't skate across.
No, I think that's right. And one of the things that I do enjoy with the time slip books, and I have done in all of them, is to discover the stories of women in particular who are footnotes, if you like, in the bigger story. So they've got a story to tell of their own, but that so often hasn't been brought out. And in fact, the 18th century inspiration for the character of Isabella in the book was a real aristocrat. In fact, Lady Diana Spencer, not the first, but the second of that name. And a lot of the elements, the domestic violence elements, were based absolutely on her life experience. so are taken directly from 18th century history and the behaviour of people in society at that time and so on. So yes, it's important certainly not to skate over those parts of the story, but I'm glad that it's balanced. I think I'd like to feel that the lighter elements balance out the darkness in there.
Well, it certainly kept me listening to the chapters one after another and gave me a few late nights. Now, not only is it multiple timelines, but it's multiple narrators. There are three voices in the book. Did you have anything to do with choosing the audiobook narrators?
Yes, that was really good fun, actually, because it was the first time I'd been involved in that, and they sent me voice clips of suggestions for the people who could narrate it and asked me to imagine who was best suited in my mind to that particular character and whether they sounded the right age and that sort of thing. So I found that a really fascinating experience to be involved in that, because although I've had a bit of an insight previously into how audiobooks were made, I've never had that much involvement in it. So it made me listen to the books in a different way as well.
As I think Wiltshire Library's writer in residence, you must be delighted that the audiobook versions have gone into the RNIB library and are there for people who are print disabled to listen to.
The Wiltshire Library thing was a while ago, but certainly, I mean, I'm a huge supporter of libraries anyway, but I think audiobook are such a great thing, so beneficial in so many ways. I was really interested to discover that generally that listening is the first language skill that you acquire, if you like. So the influence of audiobooks can be huge and really helpful. But of course, beyond that as well, I'm a huge supporter of this idea of making history and indeed books and reading accessible to as many people as possible. When I heard that the audiobook was coming out at the same time as the ebook and the paperback, I was absolutely thrilled.
Do you have any connections to sight loss?
Yes.
So you must be delighted that your books are made accessible to people who do have visual problems.
Yes, I think that's really important. I've been connected with the guide dog charity for a number of years, actually. I'm a guide dog puppy walker, but I'm also a sighted guide for blind and partially sighted people as well. So that's been incredibly important to me to learn how important audiobooks are, for example, to the people that I'm working with there. Just to be able to open up all those imaginative worlds to people and to give them that entertainment through the audiobooks is fantastic.
Did you come to that through a member of the family or a friend having sight loss?
Yes, I have got a number of both family members and friends with sight loss. It was my husband's idea to sponsor a guide dog was how we started. So that was our first connection. And then I think as we learned more about the charity and what they did and what they could do and obviously talked to family and friends as well, we wanted to become more involved. We've had 6 puppies to train so far, which has probably taken a worse toll on our pet dog than it has on us. But it's been incredibly fulfilling. And as I say, acting as a sighted guide as well is really, really interesting volunteer role that I found, again, really thought-provoking for me. And listening to audiobooks, actually, with some of the people I work with, I hear them in a completely different way, so it's fulfilling for me as well. It's lovely.
Do you think it's changed the way that you write, knowing that your books are going to be narrated?
I don't know, actually. That is a very interesting question, and I would say not consciously, but given that quite often authors will read bits of their work aloud or run through it in their head as though it's being read aloud, it probably is an unconscious influence. I wouldn't want it to be too strong, though. There's enough things inhibiting me when I'm writing as it is and thinking, does this sound right? But it's definitely in the mix there somewhere.
And are you working on a fourth timeslip novel?
Well, there's a fourth timeslip novel that I've already finished that's coming out next year, and I'm just starting the one after that. So, yes, there's plenty more in the pipeline.
You've written in several different historical periods, quite a lot of Regency, and also in the Arctic, I believe.
Oh, yes.
For one of your books. Do you have a favourite period that you come back and back to?
That is really interesting because it's very hard to choose favourite historical periods, but like choosing a favourite anything. I would have said until very recently that it was the 17th century, which is the setting for House of Shadows. And obviously, in some ways, that's my first love because of working at Ashdown and it being a 17th century house. And of course, there's so much fascinating history about around the English Civil War and the Restoration and that kind of thing. But my previous book, The Phantom Tree, was a Tudor set book, and the one I've just finished is another dual time, present day and Tudor set book. And actually, that was so much fun to discover that. I hadn't studied the Tudors since I was at university. So that was a lot of fun. And it was great just to rediscover that period. And I think it is a period that's very popular with people as well. So, yeah, I think I might have to go for that.
There are elements of fantasy in your books and you blend different genres. That's something that publishers seem a lot more prepared to accept now than maybe 20 or 30 years ago. Is it an exciting time to be able to blend and bend genres?
Yes, that is something that I do really enjoy, bringing in those different elements, because as you say, there's some supernatural stuff, there's some crime really, and you can mix it all up together. And I think that's true. I'm very fortunate that HarperCollins HQ, the imprint I write for, have always been very open to that and not trying to pigeonhole you into a particular place and say you can't do this. So there is that flexibility. And of course, if you look at a lot of the books that do really well now, I've just read The Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle, for example, it would be very hard to say exactly what that book is, and yet it would be a terrible shame to miss out on something as stimulating and interesting as that because they couldn't market it. So yeah, it's great that there is that potential now, I think. And yes, it makes you feel as though you've got the freedom to combine all kinds of elements.
I was wondering, did you grow up reading the great suspense novels or the gothic novels of the late 18th century, early 19th century?
Well, funnily enough, I didn't read gothic fiction at all. I didn't really like it very much. And I find that odd now that I've kind of come around to having gothic elements in my book. Oh, I read so many things when I was growing up. In fact, I'm sad in a way now that my reading isn't as broad as it was then. I have to do something about that, I think. But no, that was one thing that I didn't write. I didn't like things like Frankenstein. I didn't even like Jane Eyre very much because that felt a bit too, well, Wuthering Heights even more so, a bit too gothic for me. So I've only really come to that later on. It wasn't an early influence at all, but the suspense and the time slip and those sort of things were always there in my reading, I think. And also science fiction quite a lot, maybe for the fantasy element. I love John Wyndham's book, so that sort of thing all came together.
It's great to know there's a fourth and a fifth time slip novel on its way. And thank you so much for taking us through The Woman in the Lake and for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you very much.
The Woman in the Lake joins Nicola's first two time slip novels in the RNIB library, where you'll also find a selection of her romantic fiction titles. And Nicola did come back to the show to discuss The Forgotten Sister, and you can hear that interview by downloading episode 173. Now it's back to Claire Marchant for the books of her life. So Claire, was there a book that you read as a youth that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
There absolutely was. I'm going to show my age now. It's a book called The Wolves of Willoughby Chase by Joan Aitken. And I read it so many times that my copy just fell apart in the end. It has everything in it that I could have ever wanted. I was a voracious reader as a child anyway. This had friends. This had fear with the wolves. It had the bad people, it had triumph over adversity and a happy ending. And I must have read it about once every 6 months for years.
At 5 o'clock, the two children stole cautiously to the little blue powder room, which, luckily, was in a remote wing of the great house where Miss Lycop was not likely to make her way. Patton was there already and greeted them with tears and embraces. "Oh, Miss Bonnie, Miss Sylvia, my dears, what's to become of us? That's what I should like to know, with that wicked woman in charge of the house."
"We shall be all right," said Bonnie stoutly. "She can't do anything very dreadful to us. But, oh, Patton, what about you? She will have you sent to prison if she catches you here."
Charlotte Strevens narrating The Wolves of Willoughby Chase by Joan Aitken, which is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB library. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
There is. In fact, this author's books, I could read any of them on a rainy day. She's called Heidi Swain. and her books are just full of sunshine. And if it is a rainy day, my favourite is called Poppy's Recipe for Life, which is set here in Norwich, where I live. Like I say, I could read any of her books and they just make me feel happy. Wonderful books.
Poppy? Mum? I jolted upright, scattering my notes and recipe cards far and wide as I squinted at the screen. Poppy? Came her voice again. Yes, I said. I'm here. Good, because I need to talk to you. It's urgent. My heart sank. Mum and I didn't have the sort of relationship where we kept up with each other's lives. In fact, we didn't have a relationship where we kept up with each other at all. Her call was completely unexpected, and I knew from past experience that it wouldn't be littered with idle chit-chat. I only hoped it wasn't about my brother. It's about Ryan. My heart slumped further.
Karen Cass narrating Poppy's Recipe for Life by Heidi Swain, which is available commercially. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Yes, the book that I've read most recently is by a fairly new author. This is her second book. She's called Adrienne Chin, and the book is called The English Wife. It's a dual timeline, the same as I write, but it's set in the Second World War in Norwich and then also in Newfoundland, in what is now Canada, but was then not in Canada. Fascinating. The second part, the Newfoundland era, covers 9/11, when a lot of planes were diverted to Newfoundland, and what happened to the people then who had to be taken in by the locals, because it's such a small place, there weren't hotels that could put them all up. And then following that, 10 years later, there's a bit then as well. So The English Wife, I thoroughly enjoyed that.
The English Wife by Adrienne Chin will be available in audio soon. Claire Marchant, thank you so much for sharing your joy of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
You're very welcome. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
If you want to share the books of your life or ask us about anything that you've heard on Read On, the email address is radio@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. But don't forget to tune in at the same time next week, or you can always download the show as a podcast.
Just search for RNIB Audiobook Show Read On in your favourite podcast app. We're available on Apple, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and wherever you found this.
And if you can, why not rate, review, and leave us 5 stars?
Please do. Hitting like really helps us get the word out about Read On, the audiobook show.
You can find us on Twitter. I'm @RedSail, which is REDSZELL.
And I'm @Talking_books.
Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.